Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, families with special needs students say many children are being left behind and even regressing as districts continue to embrace distance learning. We'll also tell you about a new free app which connects walkers along the Circuit Trails Network to originally produced audio dramas. It's called Trail Off. But first, Pennsylvania's moratorium on evictions expires today. And for many renters whose finances have been battered by the pandemic, there is surely a sense of dread. A rental assistance program put into place over the summer has been riddled with problems. Thousands of applications for aid have stalled. Governor Wolf is calling for an overhaul of the program and an extension of the moratorium. But the legislature isn't fully back in session until September. And in the meantime, some eviction notices have already gone out. Charlotte Keith has been reporting on this story for Spotlight PA, and she joins us now with more. Hello, Charlotte.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, what a tough story. Let's begin by talking about the Renters Assistance Program, which again went into effect during the summer as pandemic relief. How does it work, Charlotte, and why is it not working for those it's supposed to serve?
Well, the way that it works is renters and landlords apply together and they can get up to $750 a month for up to 6 months. But the problem is, in many parts of the state, that's just not enough to cover even half of someone's rent. And landlords can't ask renters to make up the difference. And so as a result, a lot of landlords just don't want to take part. In Philadelphia, for example, thousands of applications have come in, but most of them can't move forward because they come from tenants whose landlords will not participate in the program.
And it's not mandatory that a landlord participates.
It's not mandatory, no. And they do need to agree to sign off and complete the application. So if you're a tenant whose landlord won't take part, there's not that much you can do.
If a landlord does agree to participate, is it smooth sailing from there? How's the application process on for both sides?
Yeah, so even for landlords who will participate or in areas of the state where rents are lower, the application process is convoluted and burdensome, people say. The goal was to direct the assistance to the people who need it the most. And so there were strict eligibility criteria put in place, and then a lot of paperwork that people have to submit to show that they meet those. And so that has created processing delays and slowed down applications being processed and then also the money being paid out.
Charlotte, you interviewed a 61-year-old man named James Pride, who is in many ways typical of those being crushed by the pandemic. Tell us his story.
So he lives in a residential complex in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, and his landlord is Morgan Properties, which is one of the biggest landlords in the state. And Morgan Properties appear to have made this decision across their dozens of complexes in Pennsylvania that they will not be taking part in the program. And he said when he heard about that, he was just crushed because it meant that he wasn't able to get that help. And he said he found it hard to understand the company's decision. You know, maybe from a business perspective, he could see where they were coming from. But he just felt that, you know, given these extraordinary circumstances and everything that's happened with the pandemic, it just wasn't fair.
As we move into September, is he in danger of eviction?
I think that's very much up in the air, and it will depend, like for a lot of people, can he go back to work? If he can, will he be able to make as much as he was before? How much money will his family be able to save? He told me they've been doing things, you know, like keeping the AC off and keeping all the lights turned off as much as possible. But like a lot of renters across the state, he's facing kind of a precarious fall.
Now, you write that housing advocates fear a wave of evictions, Charlotte. Is it correct that, again, hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvanians were not able to make rent in late July?
Yes, that's true. And, you know, evictions take time to work their way through the courts. Not all evictions that are filed result in people actually having to leave their apartments. So there is still a lot of uncertainty about what will actually happen in the next few months. Some landlords are willing to work with tenants and accept partial payments or, you know, give people more time, enter into payment plans, those kinds of things. But certainly there are a lot of landlords who say, look, if you have a tenant who can't pay rent, then you're not earning income from that property. And at some point, the eviction moratorium will expire, and then they will move to try and get someone else into the apartment.
So again, the as far as we know, today, the eviction moratorium expires. Governor Wolf says he cannot extend the ban on evictions a third time. Why not?
Well, this is a really interesting question. This came as a surprise, I think, to a lot of people in Harrisburg last week when the governor sent a letter to the legislature saying that he didn't think he had the legal authority to extend his executive order. And he pointed to a section of state law that says his authority over temporary housing only lasts 60 days. But several people have pointed out that the actions he's taken so far have already covered more than 60 days. And last week when he was asked about this at a press conference, the governor sort of muddied the waters, saying that he thought, you know, the eviction moratorium had to expire at some point, and really the priority should be fixing the rental assistance program and making changes to that, whereas extending the moratorium is just kind of a temporary solution.
So all this now lies with the Republican-led legislature, the fixes?
Yes. And while there does seem to be broad agreement that the program needs to be fixed, in fact, the agency overseeing it has been calling for some of these changes almost since the first days that applications started coming in. The big question is just the timing. The state legislature can get things done very quickly, but not always. And there's discussion about, you know, making changes to the program, but that could take weeks, whereas the moratorium expires today. Yeah. And some tenants feel like they don't have that long to wait.
So the legislature is set to reconvene sometime in September. Is there any sense of urgency among lawmakers? Have you heard anything from them, Charlotte?
I think there certainly is for some. For others, they think they still need to study more what's been going wrong and understand that more. There is a hearing that a key Senate committee will be having September 8th about the program and what needs to be changed. And certainly some lawmakers feel that that is too long to wait, and that the fixes that need to be made are already clear and could be done sooner.
In the meantime, of course, evictions proceedings can proceed, I guess, tomorrow, because the moratorium will be lifted by then.
Yes, and probably, you know, there is a great backlog of eviction filings that has built up. So probably the first cases that will be dealt with are the ones that are from back in March. But certainly, yes, there is a time crunch here. And I think there is a big question, you know, making changes to the program would clearly be helpful, but could it come too late for some tenants who may already be in eviction proceedings by the time that the program is tweaked to help them more?
Charlotte Keith is an investigative reporter with Spotlight PA, and she joins us for the next few minutes here on the Regional Roundup. Charlotte, as you report, a Spotlight PA review found that Pennsylvania's primary effort to help renters pay their bills was severely flawed from the start. Any thoughts as a journalist as to why?
Well, I think what's important to remember is this was one of these programs. It's funded with CARES Act funding that the state got from the federal government. And all of these aid programs had to be developed, stood up, rolled out incredibly quickly. The legislature that governs this program was written very quickly. And then in terms of getting it up and running, it's really unprecedented speed, you know, for a new government program of this size. And so certainly I think people point to that as one reason there have been issues. And also that, you know, there's a balance between wanting to direct limited funding strategically to make it go as far as possible. A lot of these programs, you know, Philadelphia's previous rental assistance program was just overwhelmed with applications. And, you know, the demand was much greater than the money available. And so anticipating that kind of a situation, the law contained measures to kind of stretch the money further and to help more people to some extent rather than, you know, a fewer number completely. But in practice, that created other problems. And almost the situation now is reversed, that there is all this money available, but there are concerns that it won't all be used up by the program's deadline because of the various hurdles that have been put in place.
And that was the next question. The program was given, I think it was $150 million under the CARES Act, the Federal CARES Act. So you're saying if the money isn't flowing out to those who need it, you know, essentially because the program's not working, that money will not remain in place indefinitely. It goes away.
Right. And that is something that is being discussed as one of the changes to the program, is to extend that application deadline to give people more time, you know, once the fixes have been made. But all of these programs funded with CARES Act money, they have a deadline. The goal is to get this money out quickly. It's not something the state can sit on into next year. And so in terms of the time frame to make adjustments and get the money flowing, there isn't that much time to figure it out.
What changes does Governor Wolf want to see in the rental assistance program?
So probably the biggest thing is replacing the $750 cap with a more flexible standard that would vary from metro area to metro area, as well as making it easier so that, you know, tenants can... Landlords don't have to accept that full amount if it doesn't cover all of the rent. So they could enter into a payment plan with tenants, or maybe tenants could pay them the difference. There's also a discussion about taking away a requirement that people already be at least a month behind on their rent, because the thinking was that was unfair to people who had scrimped and saved and made other sacrifices for their other bills to pay rent. If you're not currently behind, you don't qualify under the current rules. Another one is to specifically clarify that landlords cannot add late fees during this time. But again, with all of these, I think the balance is between things that landlords want and things that tenants want, even though broadly speaking, having rental assistance money available is seen as a win for both.
Yeah.
There's concern that if the program is changed to make things more favorable to landlords, then, for example, tenants could get the money and end up being evicted anyway.
Quick look at what is happening in Philadelphia. You referenced this a little bit earlier in our conversation, but so many of the applications, the thousands of applications submitted so far in Philly, have not moved forward because they're from tenants whose landlords won't participate. Has any money been paid out to renters in need in Philadelphia at this point, Charlotte?
No, I can tell you at least as of last Friday, no money has been paid out. All of those applications are still being processed. And so even for people whose landlords did sign off and who would take part, that's a nerve-wracking wait if you applied, you know, at the beginning of July for this, when this first opened, and you're still waiting to see, will you get the money and how much will you get?
All right. Charlotte Keith, investigative reporter with Spotlight PA, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And just ahead on the regional roundup, we're going to be joined by special education attorney Dan Cooper. We're going to be talking about the new school year and how it might work for children with special needs. Advocates say that difficulties in remote learning is causing...
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
A lot of difficulties for these kids. Stay with us for more of the Regional Roundup. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Back to school is upon us, and COVID-19 remains a game changer for teachers and students as districts choose to make classes virtual, hybrid, or in person 5 days a week. When it comes to distance learning, children with special needs are among those most negatively affected. And for the next 20 minutes, we're going to look at the daunting challenges facing many of these young people and their families a half year into the pandemic, and how school districts are responding. Phones are open if you've got questions or comments. 888-477-9499. Send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Dan Cooper is a lawyer and advocate, managing attorney at the law offices of Kenneth S. Cooper, a special education firm in the Philadelphia area, which serves parents of children with special needs at no cost to the family. Welcome, Dan.
Mary, thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Let's begin by getting a sense, Dan, of who you work with, the families. When we speak of special needs, what sorts of challenges are we talking about?
So we're representing families throughout the Delaware Valley, primarily in Philadelphia, oftentimes families that have socioeconomic difficulties and families that even during normal times when there is no pandemic are often struggling to get the services they need from underfunded schools. And what we've seen happening through the pandemic is that the needs of children have simply grown and the access and ability of children to access education has really gotten in the way of children making progress. It is not going to get better anytime soon.
You say IEPs were non-existent in the spring, individualized education programs or plans. Tell us about the importance of the IEP to a special needs student's success and the fallout if the IEP disappears.
So the IEP is a child's individualized program. And what the IEP does is it really shows a family how their child is doing, and it really dictates to a school staff, here is how we have to program for a child. Every single child with special needs has their own IEP. The law and the guidance that has come from both the state and the federal government has been clear, which is that schools must implement IEPs to the best of their reasonable ability to do so. Children that have more severe disabilities oftentimes are spending more and more time within a special education classroom. And where a child oftentimes might get 10, 15, 20, 25 hours a week of instruction in a special education classroom, we saw in the spring and unfortunately expect to continue to see in the fall, kids getting something like 30 minutes two or three times a week instead of that 10 to 25 plus hours. So there is a massive decline in the amount of service a child is getting.
Tell us more about the decline and why. Why is there such a decline?
Well, I think there's many reasons. I think in the spring there was a basically emergency situation where schools were scrambling and really did not know what to do. And I think schools unfortunately hid behind this best of their reasonable ability standard and really said, well, 30 minutes three times a week, that's good enough. And there's no case law to say otherwise. There's no judge yet to say otherwise. That's the best we can do. I think beyond that, you certainly have, from the school standpoint, teachers that are thrust into a situation where they've never been before.
Yeah, sure.
Teachers charged with raising their own kids at home that cannot give the time, energy, and effort that they were able to give before when they were in the classroom.
Why is virtual learning so much more difficult for students with special needs? What have you heard from families?
Well, a lot of students with special needs really necessitate the one-on-one, hands-on approach to learning. I think that's especially true for children on the autism spectrum, children with intellectual disabilities, where they really need a teacher next to them, oftentimes a one-on-one aide, in a really small setting. And to ask those types of children to stare at their computer screen, to be able to focus, to be able to pay attention, to be able to get a lot of the social, emotional, behavioral based reinforcement that they consistently get in a classroom is frankly next to impossible. It cannot be done. And having dealt with cyber charter schools, which have existed in the Philadelphia area and statewide for quite a number of years now, you know, we've seen for years that cyber charters that have developed programs all day, year after year after year, continually fail to educate children on the autism spectrum with emotional disabilities, with intellectual disabilities. It really cannot be done effectively.
Fair to say that in the spring when this thing hit, when the pandemic hit, you know, it was really tough for districts to scramble to meet the needs of students with special needs, you know, virtually. All new for everybody, really, but that things need to change in the fall as we're about to begin, you know, a new school year now that we have some experience under our collective belts. Is that fair?
Oh, it's 100% fair.
Okay.
We have known since March that this was a possibility. And as time went on, the possibility that we would remain virtual crystallized. And therefore, schools have had certainly the ability to dedicate more resources, both in terms of time as well as fiscal resources, to developing better programs. The computer simply needs to be looked at as another form of a classroom. And if a child goes to a math class or a reading class and they are struggling in that class, the schools can make quite a number of accommodations within that classroom, providing extra support. You know, if a child elopes from the classroom, we don't just let them wander the hallways. We find a way to get them back into the classroom. And with the computer, we have to do the same exact thing. If the child is unable to access instruction, can we give them additional time with a teacher? Can we give them a one-on-one aid? If a child is not logging in, what do? We talk to the family. We reach out. Maybe it's the time of the class. Maybe there's a lack of internet access. So schools cannot make the same types of excuses they made in the spring, that they did not know this was coming, that this is an unprecedented emergency. It's still an emergency, but we have had now 6 months, especially for kids that went through the summer, which are a lot of special education kids, to really plan and prepare and make sure that, you know, things go better. It's not going to be like in-person learning, but it should not be nothing. And for a lot of the families that certainly my office serves, the spring was nothing. They might as well have been taking a nap or playing video games. They got so little instruction.
Okay, let's bring Marissa into the conversation. She is calling into the regional roundup, a parent of a special needs child and also a parent advocate. Welcome, Marissa. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. All of my comments were just said by the attorney online. I just want to say he described everything perfectly. I happen to have a child who can access the special ed curriculum virtually, and he does have the support of me at home. But as was just stated, there's been a lot of excuse making, and I happen to just speak with my school recently, and I see that being replicated again. And what I find is, although there was scrambling in the spring, and we need to validate that, and we need to understand how difficult the transition was, there were months and months to plan. And what I'm seeing as we approach a Wednesday start date, this Wednesday, is a total lack of seriousness about extending those supports, even so much as having a meet and greet with my son, who has a brand new team this year. That's a simple thing to do in a week where you've had plenty of time to reach out and help him with this transition.
So, Marissa, if you could, just because we're up against the clock, you know, without revealing too much personal information, just give us a sense of your son's challenges and how this affected him in schooling in the spring, and what you need from your school district this fall to get him back on track.
Sure. My son is on the autism spectrum disorder. He needs attention support. He needs accommodated curriculum. He needs help with transition. So instead of having, say, one classroom, he has probably 10, and this was a problem in the spring. So if the school was serious about accommodating a classroom, that is a simple thing to do, and that would actually support all the other children. He is fully included in the general education classroom, and it's been made a little impossible for him to be in his least restrictive environment, given a lack of planning.
So I'm not sure which district you're referring to where you are right now, but with
Philadelphia.
Okay. So it's all virtual for Philadelphia, at least to start the school year, as I understand. Do you feel your son needs to have some face-to-face education to really stay on track?
I think that would be the best case scenario. However, given the situation we're in, given his parents and needs at home, I don't see that happening. I have three children in three different schools in Philadelphia. It becomes quite complicated, and in our feeling as parents, quite risky. I can't imagine my son being in school, having to be 6 feet distance from his one-to-one, wearing a mask all day, being separated from his peers, not enjoying any of the fun social interaction. So I don't quite see the benefits for my son, but for other children with deeper needs, they have to be in person. We can do it at home, given my son's level and his intellect and his abilities. But for other children, they need to be in full time and not a hybrid 2 days. They need 5 days.
So, Dan Cooper, a tough question then when we're talking about virtual education. Is the risk of regression so great for certain students that it outweighs the hopefully small risk of being exposed to the virus in a classroom type setting?
I certainly believe so. And I say that with the caveat of we have to assume that classrooms can open safely. And what I mean by that is, when we're talking about high incidence kids, certainly kids higher incidence than Marissa's child, we're talking about kids that cannot learn virtually, and we're talking about a small percentage of kids where when they were in the school building, oftentimes they were in a self-contained classroom with maybe 6, 7, 8 kids. There is no reason that school districts cannot set up school buildings that are specific to dealing with kids that are high incidence. And therefore, you have a small number of kids in the building, you are able to have social distancing, you are able to have PPE, there is a relatively low risk. And certainly beyond that, for families, we can give them the option. We have this available in the building, we are going to make it as safe as humanly possible. We are not talking about hundreds of kids roaming the hallways. And if you, as a parent, do not feel safe sending your child into that type of environment, then we will do the best we possibly can virtually, which, you know, as I've said ad nauseum, did not happen in the spring.
Marissa, how are you preparing your son for the school year, which starts Wednesday in Philly?
So we're speaking to him about it. We have had him engage with his one-to-one, who is the same one-to-one as the second half of last year. His old teacher called him to talk to him about school, and we're just going to take it one step at a time. That's all you can ever do with a child who has to process things differently. And I would say I'm doing that for all three of my children. I'm almost more concerned about the children with really high needs and the seven to eight in a classroom that were just mentioned. And if we could do that correctly, maybe we could be more serious about the kids in general education that need support. But this is a problem across multiple districts. And if we keep letting the regressions grow as we did in the spring, I'm not sure what we're going to do with my son.
So, Dan Cooper, for those families whose children have greater challenges, what recourse is there?
Well, there's legal recourse, and certainly what we're not trying to do is advocate that every family in the city of Philadelphia bring a lawsuit against their school district. However, we are concerned that without strong advocacy, children will fall through the cracks. There will be extreme regression. I think that is furthered by the fact that literally every child that is not in school right now, once they come back, we're going to have to take a look at where they stand. Where is their reading level? Where is their math level? Where are their behaviors? You know, kids are now suffering all sorts of trauma that they didn't suffer before. You know, maybe a family member got sick or passed away or lost a job. So it really is going to be important for families to take a look at their child and their child's program and say, where are they now? What were they supposed to be getting back when the school buildings were open? What are they getting now? How much of a difference is there in that programming? And let's set up a meeting as quickly as possible, talk to the teachers, talk to the school staff, figure out how programming can, if necessary, be improved upon, and where schools are not making those best reasonable efforts, parents really should be seeking support, whether from myself, another law firm, a parent advocate. It oftentimes takes that type of push to ensure that children's needs are being appropriately met.
Marissa, how are you imagining what I imagine? How are you managing what I imagine must be the real stress of this situation, you and your children?
Well, when you're a parent of a special needs child, the stress begins the moment they get a diagnosis. So at a certain point, my child's going into sixth grade. The battling for services started when he was three. So I think I probably am in a better situation to manage the stress of being in school and not having your child get what they need, because that's what we've lived for 9 years. We're all suffering. What we do for our children is to try to bring out the most positive time and the benefits of being at home and being together, and so that makes life a little less stressful. I happen to be in a situation where I'm sort of retired. I'm an older parent, and I do have that time, but everybody can't do that. And if my husband were the only parent, there'd be no way for him to do that. So I guess just trying to be as positive as possible and looking for benefits and enjoying time with my children is the answer.
All right. Well, best of luck to you and your child and your entire family as we move to the new school year. Dan Cooper, about 20 seconds left. Any final thoughts from you?
Stay vigilant. You know, this is going to be a time for families where advocacy matters, and as much as they can help their children achieve, now is the time. Do not wait to seek help. Do not wait to seek support.
All right. Dan Cooper is a managing attorney at the law offices of Kenneth S. Cooper, a special education firm in the Philadelphia area. Thank you so much as well. And just ahead on the regional roundup, we talk about Trail Off, an app which contains stories that are paired with Philly's Circuit Trail Network. A lot of fun. Project's organizer Adrian Mackey joins us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Tuned. You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Walking a trail can be a welcome tonic to the many challenges of life, but soon a new app will provide even more to the experience of fresh air and gorgeous scenery. Trail Off will offer 10 original audio stories written by local authors, dramas which unfold over various routes within the Philadelphia region's Circuit Trails Network and which feature high-tech navigational cues and music. Trail Off premieres with the start of the upcoming Fringe Festival as a free-to-download mobile app created by Swim Pony Performing Arts in collaboration with the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. And joining us now to tell us more is Adrian Mackey, founder and artistic director of Swim Pony. Hi, Adrian.
Hi there.
So what an intriguing and creative and fun idea. How did it come about?
I think my company for a long time has been really interested in sort of taking the tools of theater into new spaces and trying to both kind of like wake up our senses and also make things more accessible. Being outdoors is definitely one way to do that. And I'm also a distance runner and had often been running with podcasts in my ears and would hear these stories and sort of think to myself, gosh, I wish these were actually connected to the place I was in. Once we sort of like found this like amazing triangle between Swim Pony, the Pennsylvania Environmental Council, and our app developer Toaster Lab, sort of all the pieces came together to make this really unique combination.
So I just gave a brief sketch of the experience, but if you would, Adrian, really walk us through it. What can we expect if we download the app and then hit a trail that's featured in the drama?
So if you download the app, you'll get a list of the different stories that are available, and you can search them, you know, sort of by location or by story. You can get a little preview. Once you pick one to actually experience, you've got directions to the trailhead, and you can download the content. And then you just show up and hit play, and the GPS will sort of take care of the story for you. So once you start walking the route, you'll get this narrative experience. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people maybe have a little bit of time wrapping their head around. I think some people think it's educational or a history tour. Some of the pieces do incorporate local history or facts, but they're really narrative. So they're intended to be creative experiences. And, you know, each one's a little bit different, but they all sort of gently kind of cast you from the perspective of a central character or narrator. So as you walk, the characters are referring to things around you. The story is actually sort of set in the place that you're in, and you can walk at any pace you want. The story will sync to you as you move.
All right. Well, we get to sample some of the trail off dramas this hour. Let's get to the first clip from The Land Remembers by author Jacob Winterstein, which is set in the Eastwick neighborhood in Philadelphia.
We stopped paddling right here and just let the raft float. It barely moved. I looked back towards the meadows, at the part of the pond I imagine has always looked the same. Ox looked the other way, towards the airport. He wondered if flying felt like sitting on a raft. If sitting on the air felt like sitting on the water.
So that's The Land Remembers, and again, the author is Jacob Winterstein. Adrian, a pointed comparison between the environment then and now. Intriguing.
Mm.
Who is the person who voices this?
Actually, sort of a fun fact, our sound designer and composer for the piece's son is a performer. Mm-hmm. So when Jacob wrote that story and we knew that we needed a younger actor, we went to Simon Kiley, who's Michael Kiley's son. So that was sort of like a fun, exciting opportunity to have somebody who we knew really well in the recording studio for that one.
All right, let's go to another clip. Carmen Maria Machado has written a story called The River Keeper, and this takes place along the Manayunk Canal.
People forget about how Manayunk used to be this industrial powerhouse. So much stuff was made here.
Like what?
You know, paper, nails, steel, soap. Did you hear that?
Hear what? I think we should hustle a little faster and maybe get some B-roll before we...
Stop. 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 Mercedes? You can't hear it? That song?
And again, that's River Devil from, or The River Keeper, I'm sorry, from Carmen Maria Machado. Pardon me?
So it's actually, the name is kind of funny. It's River Devil 2, The Return. So it's got sort of like that old school horror movie feel.
Oh, it does. It does. And thanks for the correction. But yeah, for those who... who like to feel a bit of fright? It does sound like it's it's got that element. But again, you know, as you're walking, if you're walking along the trail and you've got the app and you you know, there are navigational cues that are happening, and it's all based on GPS. So flesh that out a little bit more for us, say with this particular piece.
So with this one, you start on the Manayunk Canal towpath, which is sort of in the downtown area of Manayunk. And the story is sort of, the conceit of the story is that you're sort of following these two production assistants who are shooting behind the scenes footage for a horror movie. And as you walk north, you're actually walking sort of out of the downtown urban area, really into the woods. So the characters are sort of talking about these sites where these murders that maybe or maybe were not committed by a human, I'm not going to say if it's a monster, and you're actually like looking at these locations. And as you're physically walking, you're getting out into sort of these like creepier and creepier parts of the woods. So by the time you hit the end of the story, there's this kind of like amazing synchronicity. I know when the last time I walked it, you know, I was sort of all alone and you're hearing this incredible sound design all around you. So it's sort of a fully immersive experience.
Oh, it just sounds wonderful. I might take a buddy with me for that one.
Yeah.
So let's talk, Adrienne, about how you found the authors for Trail Off. Your site says they demonstrate both rigorous artistic practice and connections to communities traditionally underserved by environmental programming. Expand on that for us.
So, you know, part of the aim of the project really is to, I think, expand the stories we think about when we think of nature. You know, if I were to say, like, think of a nature trail, I think a lot of people would kind of have an immediate image flash in their mind. And if you think about, like, who belongs on a nature trail, you know, you might also have a similar idea, probably white, middle class, educated. And the truth is these spaces are public. They're free to everybody. And so the stories we tell in them should sort of be equivalently diverse. And that's the core of the project. So when PEC, the Pennsylvania Environmental Council, and I set out to find the collaborating artists, we really started from a conversation. I think I sent maybe like 1,000 emails to artists all across the Philadelphia region just saying, are you someone or do you know someone who'd be interested in this project that's, you know, taking place outdoors in this context, that's using this new technology, but also does your work speak to a perspective that you don't see reflected enough there? And we really let the authors sort of tell us why they felt like the work that they made or sort of their mission as an artist aligned with the project. And the 10 folks who ended up taking part, I think, were so deeply embedded in sort of all of those components. And I think the final products just really speak to how deeply they're thinking about, like, I just how to expand and transform the way we might think about walking on a trail.
Yeah. Was there an editorial process? Were you involved in helping to shape these dramas?
I mean, my core aim of the project is like largely facilitation. You know, I always said to the writers, my aim is really to bring your vision to life. So the authors always had sort of final editorial say over their own works. What I was really trying to do was use my skills as a theater director who's worked in site-based performance and also is talking to the sound designer and the app developer to say, you know, here's how I think this is going to translate best as a user experience. So, you know, maybe the writing you have is like a little long for this section and it might bump up against the next mm-hmm. GPS trigger, or here's how I think we're going to translate music to carry somebody to the next part of the story. You know, and I read all the stories and obviously talk a lot with the authors and tried to offer myself up as a sounding board. But at the end of the day, I really wanted them to feel like their work was theirs.
So back to the navigational cues. What happens, Adrienne, if a person accidentally goes off trail?
So there's a lot of things that are built into the app that we'll get to see, you know, sort of for the first time when it launches to the public. And hopefully this first month of launch will be an opportunity for us to, like, get a lot of feedback and just continue to iterate it. But the basic idea, there's a character who we call the Ranger, who's voiced by a local performer, Starfire, and is written by playwright T.S. Hawkins. And the Ranger is, we sort of jokingly call her Black Siri. So she sort of shows up at the beginning and says, like, here's some information, here's how it works. And if you ever go off the wrong path, the Ranger will either give you a sound cue or in some cases like an actual sort of navigational direction to say, like, oops, you took the wrong path, like head back this way. So we're hoping that we've actually built almost kind of like Google Maps, you know, a series of cues so that if you do navigate wrong, we can get you back on course.
Okay, we've got one more clip for our listeners. This is a clip from, is it the Sycamore Song or Psalm? I'm not sure. I'm trying to read my writing here.
Yeah.
Okay. By Dunia Salim Harhur. And let's take a listen.
Teta and Mama insist I still have so many memories from before that I can recall if I just try. They push me to stretch my mind back, back into the bedrock of myself. This just makes me back away, tired and hidden. How much more do they want me to cry for a return that cannot come? I am an eggshell boat on the Perkiomen Creek, trying to keep from coming apart.
Well, the narrative's beautiful. And again, yes, it's set along the Perkiomen Creek and Trail. Adrienne, this seems to me to, there's a sense of sorrow here, and it also speaks to environmental degradation, if I'm correct, just from that one clip. And really, again, you know, at the heart of all of these, there is an environmental message. Is that correct?
Yeah, you hit it exactly on the head. And I think Dunya's piece really speaks to the way that the personal stories are both, you know, they are personal, intimate stories that are also reflected in these larger metaphors. And Dunya's piece explores some of her own experience with caretaking and family and health issues and sort of how that's also reflected in the deforestation and devastation of the landscape. And it becomes just this beautiful poetic piece that's operating both on this really intimate level, but then also just makes you look at the space around and just think about, you know, sort of these larger issues of like how we as humans on the biggest level are impacting the landscape.
In speaking with our producer, John Ahrens, you mentioned that participatory theater can be unpopular with some people. Are you thinking this sort of theater, this app might change some minds, hearts and minds?
I mean, that's really my hope. You know, I think that, you know, one of the, I think in a funny way, sometimes experimental theater can have a similar diversity problem that you can see in the environmental sector. You know, it takes a lot of information to like show up at the right time. Ticket prices can be really expensive. Yeah. And I don't think there's anything about immersive experience that is prohibitive, but I think a lot of the barriers to get there can be. And so one of the hopes is that, you know, if you can download this onto any kind of phone and do it whenever you want to and do it at whatever pace you want to totally for free, that a lot more people are going to feel welcome and comfortable doing artistic experiences like this.
So it doesn't matter how quickly or slowly a person walks.
Yeah, you can really go. I mean, if you run, you might bump things up. It's a walking experience, but I think sort of whatever pace you're walking at, the app will work.
So, Adrienne, for those who aren't familiar with the Circuit Trail Network, it stretches over, I think it's 300 miles at least, through 9 counties in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. How did you decide which sections of trail would provide the settings for these dramas?
That was a real collaboration with the Pennsylvania Environmental Council and I. Lizzie Hessick, who's my program manager, has been a really deep collaborator on the project. And she and I worked super closely to just think about, you know, how can we represent the real range of spaces that the circuit covers? So there are urban trails, suburban trails, rural trails. Some of them are incredibly bucolic. We sort of call those the nature trails with a capital N. And some of them are maybe spaces that you might not immediately think of going to.
Such as?
And part of the hope. There's one over across the river in Camden at the Cooper River Trail at Gateway Park. And it's actually a space that I drive past on a fairly regular basis. And I didn't realize there was a trail there until doing this project. And the piece that author Afak has written, which is called The Way Sand Wants for Water, it's such a beautiful piece. And now every time I drive past that stretch of land that I would otherwise have totally unremarked on, I just think about her story. So, you know, part of the aim really is to like get us to look at places in totally new ways and with fresh eyes.
Well, it all sounds intriguing and just again like so much fun. And it was such a pleasure to have you with us, Adrienne Mackey. You are founder and artistic director of Swim Pony Performing Arts. And again, Trail Off, the app should be available around the start of the Fringe Festival.
Yep, starting in September 11th.
Okay. Well, thanks again.
All righty.
And don't forget, you can find us at the Regional Roundup on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. John Ahrens is producer for the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks so much for joining us. Be well.